You're listening to Perspective on WFHR 1320 AM 97.5 FM. I'm Melissa Kay, bringing you news in our community. During this interview, I'm talking with Representative Scott Krug on Friday, March 6th. Thank you for joining me, Scott, to bring the community an update from the 72nd Assembly District.
Yeah, always happy to be on. It's always a good conversation, so I'm excited about it.
I'm glad to have you here. And February was a pretty crazy busy month for the State Assembly. During the second to last week of February, you were in session almost every single day.
It seemed like we were there like nonstop for like 4 days. But yes, there were 3.5 session days, and the last one dragged on to the end just to get some final agreements. But we got our work done, so there's a lot to digest and talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dive right in. One of the things that is going to be on the forefront of people's minds in this area is that the PSC, the Public Service Commission, approved the NextEra solar project in the town of Rome, despite community pushback. What can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the PSC is still undefeated, right? No matter how many times people go to them complaining about local issues on zoning requirements for solar, the PSC continues to grant these applications. Yesterday was the same. Even on the docket, they had talked about it being a file review, but actually pushed through the approval at the same meeting. So folks down by me in Rome are pretty upset and saddened about that today. I don't think it's anything to do with solar whatsoever. I think there were concerns more about, hey, have you even been to our town to see what the impact of this might be? Have you really gotten a good flavor of who we are and how these fit in our towns? And I think it just underscored, you know, exactly how that PSC process is broken now that these 31 projects in a row have just been granted without any denials ever being issued. So it's a weird message for the PSC to send, is that these projects fit no matter where anybody applies for them. And I don't like dealing with absolutes, but it's, you know, always and nevers are never a good thing. So I'm going to try to reform that process a little bit because it just seems like it's broken.
Well, because there was a number of hearings that were held actually in Nacusa, and people drove over from the town of Rome to give testimony before the PSC. And there were a lot of, there was NextEra representatives there. There were multiple representatives from the Public Service Commission. But that decision is still only made by three people?
Yeah, so when we had the public hearings, first of all, they actually made the residents in Rome drive to Nacusa, which I thought was just bizarre. The town hall would be more than able to fit the needs of a public hearing, but that's how out of touch I think the commissioners were. And there was nobody from the PSC there. It was an administrative law judge who basically takes a testimony with a court reporter and just records it for PSC commissioners to read or review later. So none of these three commissioners who make the final decision had any interaction with the town, period, and they don't in any of these projects. And I think that's the biggest problem, is I think the commissioners for these projects across the state should come to the actual community and actually hear from the people directly. And I think that process is where we really have a disconnect in what works and what doesn't. So we had 2,000 people signing petitions saying we don't want it out of 3,000 people that live in the town of Rome. We had, you know, 38 people show up to the public hearing, myself included, to kind of say, hey, I don't know if you're really paying attention to this exactly how we're trying to frame it. But even during their discussion yesterday, it was pretty cursory to say, okay, well, the applicant said this, and I think we agree. And then to vote on it right away when it wasn't even put on the docket that there was going to be a vote, I think was another part of the process that was in need of dire reform.
So now you have Assembly Bill 493, which is an effort to restore local control over large wind and solar projects in rural communities. Can you speak about this bill?
Yeah, AB 493 is a direct answer to these applications. It wasn't just the town of Rome. It's the town of Saratoga project we saw approved a little while back. It's the town of Grant project on the Prairie Chicken land that we saw approved a year or so ago. My area has just been a hot spot for all of these developers coming to want to put the projects in because we have the land. And I think just, you know, to put this bill together was twofold. To say, one, Let's restore some local decision making into this process where PSC, you go gather the information, put together the file. You can make an approval or a recommendation, I should say, to approve or deny, and then send it on to a local body of government for the final approval. Second part of that bill was saying, hey, if we're going to do all these large-scale solar projects, why don't we open that up for private developers or private landowners to also develop solar projects on their property? Because it's not technically allowed right now in the state of Wisconsin to do a 20-acre, you know, 15-megawatt project. So we wanted to say, hey, if we're going to do solar and we're going to have buy-in on solar, it's going to have to be done with local communities and not to local communities. So the AB 493, it tackles it two ways, saying, hey, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander, and private developers can also be a part of the process. And all projects, wind, solar, any renewable project, has to get at least an affirmative vote from a local unit of government. I think that's just fair.
And there are multiple Republicans who have signed on to this bill. Do you feel that this bill has bipartisan support?
You know, in any other political climate, I would say that there could be bipartisan support for it. But now that this bill has gotten to the point that we're at the end of our legislative session and we are in an election year, I think that's what's kept Democrats from signing on to the bill. In other states where you look for local approval or you look at community solar individually, there are Democrats that support these bills in other states. But I think the idea of bipartisan sign on to bills at the beginning of an election cycle makes it tougher for that bipartisanship to be apparent. But I do think there are some votes for it within the Democrat caucuses in the Assembly and the Senate.
So with that being stated, Scott, I'd like to digress just slightly from this bill and have you speak on that aspect. Is that the best use of effort from our politicians for the people when they on to each a bill just because it's the beginning of an election year?
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, it's just it sometimes you see what happens in Madison as more of a kabuki theater than anything else. And there are certain times of the year where politicians get skittish about doing the right thing at the right time. And I think this is one of those seasons where there's so much uncertainty going on in what the next election might look like that they're not worried about the next solution. So I have encouraged my Democrat colleagues to be able to sign on to these bills. Lord knows I've signed on to enough Democrat bills this session. I don't get the reluctance because doing the right thing at the right time, it just, that's what makes sense to my constituents. And like I said, if these got to a floor vote, I would imagine there would be some Democrats that would vote for it. It's been a lot more bipartisan votes overall this session because you've seen a lot of Democrats in the state assembly voting for Republican bills, finally, including the state budget. I just think the signing on to the bill is something they're not exactly sure they want to do for some reason. So sometimes it is what it is, and we're still going to push good ideas at the right time. And this is a good idea at the right time.
Well, and now through the rest of this, there's very few floor periods left before the end of this.
Right. Yeah, we had an executive session. We did the exec on AB 493 the day before our final floor session in the assembly. So the reason we did that was to make sure that if there is a special session or an extraordinary session added to the calendar, that this bill is ready, right? We don't have to go to committee. It can be pulled up right away. So yes, we are out of regular floor dates in the state assembly right now, but there is always an opportunity. As you saw, the governor called a special session on redistricting this week. I think he should call a special session on public service commission reforms and energy and utility issues, because my constituents talk about that way more than anything else right now. They're talking about how their utility bills are increasing nonstop and how the affordability in the state of Wisconsin is getting harder and harder. These reforms really matter, and that's what I'm holding out hope for, is that we either convince legislative leaders to do an extraordinary session day or the governor to call a special session.
Well, we will take a pause for a short moment here to hear from our sponsors. I'm Melissa Kay talking with Representative Scott Krug, and you're listening to Perspective on 1320 AM, 97.5 FM, WFHR. Welcome. You're listening to Perspective on WFHR 1320 AM, 97.5 FM. I'm Melissa Kay, bringing you news in our community. I'm speaking with Representative Scott Krug, and where we left off, we were talking about Senate sessions and assembly sessions on the floor, bills that need to be signed. But now let's move into the recent panel that was hosted by the Rental Housing Coalition that you participated in. Anyone who's tried to find a rental property in the last couple of years knows what a challenge it is to find a place that's both affordable and located near where you're employed. And safety is also a factor to consider. If you're a family living with children in an apartment complex without a sprinkler system, I would think that that'd be a serious concern. Let's talk about this housing coalition that you participated in.
Yeah, it was a great panel. I think we ended up filling a room full of probably, I'd say, 400 to 500 individuals who are investor landlords, property owners across the entire state of Wisconsin, who wanted to know, you know, how we can protect their investment but still make sense for their tenants to occupy safe buildings that are affordable for families. And, you know, something we very much stressed to that crowd was that the housing crisis across the country impacts Wisconsin, and it's not just people trying to buy homes, but it's renters. When there's a shortage of properties, renters are paying astronomical amounts for rents across the entire state of Wisconsin and the country as a whole. And that was where the juxtaposition came in on requirements from government to retrofit buildings, more regulation. Those things end up landing on the landlord, right? And the landlord's not just going to eat costs, he's going to pass it on to tenants. So there really is a fine line on trying to implement more requirements on older buildings to retrofit them. And it really does impact affordability. So we really wanted to make sure that landlords understand, and the vast majority of these landlords, I'll say, are mom and pop types. They're not, you know, big, you know, investment companies by any stretch of the means. Trying to help them understand that the property that they bought, they can provide assistance to somebody to rent, is something we want to protect that ability for them to do. Because as I can tell you as a real estate agent, that more and more landlords in the Wisconsin Rapids area are getting frustrated with being able to rent, period, and are selling those properties. When those properties sell, there's less rental options, and of course, rental prices go up. So the panel really did talk a lot about, hey, yeah, we understand safety and regulation are concerns, but I think the bigger concern right now for both sides of the equation is affordability and being able to actually have units available. So we're really focused on trying to get more housing starts going in the state of Wisconsin, encouraging developers to come to Wisconsin and start using some of the bills we've passed, like development by right, that says, hey, if a community has set rules in place and you want to develop, they can't change the rules midstream. Mm-hmm. We did AB 202 just to make sure there's more clarity on the landlord-tenant communication process and the rights and responsibilities of both parties, to make sure that every transaction is fair and easily distinguished as a occupant-tenant agreement, or if it's something that has to, you know, run through the courts if there's a problem. So really, I've spent a lot of time on trying to make sure that rental options exist and that they're affordable.
Well, and part of that affordability concerns, as we've talked offline, I've lived in a lot of rental apartments and rental properties over the course of my life. I also used to property manage for a little bit in the area here. And then when I was a teenager, my mom and I had a cleaning and painting business where we would clean apartments and rental properties after people moved out for the next tenants to come in. So I have a bit of experience with this. And part of the affordability issue that I have seen is that when contractors and builders are putting up these properties, sometimes they use some really cheap options to build. I mean, cheap windows and doors, they're inefficient. And those costs are passed on to the tenants because they're paying higher heating bills, cooling bills. Stuff gets broken easier, so then they get charged for it when they move out. I mean, I know that wanting to lower costs to build is important, but what about the importance of also building apartment and housing that's going to have a longer life and sustainability for renters?
And that's probably one of the biggest things we do in every state budget is we continue to fund programs like Community Action here in Wisconsin Rapids, where we are able to say, okay, you've moved into this property, and through no fault of your own, it's very energy inefficient and it's costing you more money, renter. So the state budget allocates money to companies and partners and NGOs like Community Action to be able to retrofit those properties to make sure that you're going to save some money because we're actually going to increase the energy efficiency of buildings throughout the state of Wisconsin if a landlord did or did not do what they were supposed to do originally upon building it. I mean, it's hard to, with most of the housing stock here in Wisconsin Rapids, most of it has been built pre-1980s, and trying to retrofit all of those old mill worker homes, I call them, is a challenge, but that is exactly why I think there's so much emphasis and push to make sure their community action programs are available to do the rental weatherization that they do across the board. Now, the newer developments, like you see a lot of it around the west side of Wisconsin Rapids right now, newer developments are under new building codes. That's also something that's just recently happened in the state of Wisconsin as we've updated the building code again. So any newer development is already under the new building code structures. So those materials are less able to be used by and verified by building inspectors, granting permits for local building properties. So try to stay on it as much as we can. It's just the old housing stock that we have in Rapids makes it very hard to get those properties up to snuff where they should be under the new building code standards.
Well, and there are things that renters themselves can do and apply for if they're living in a place that does need that retrofitting.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the community action type programs. That rental weatherization program is a godsend. I think that's something we've really tried to really beef up the money for it in the state budget the last few cycles.
Well, let's move into another issue that affects everybody in the state, and that's PFAS. AB 130 and 131 is dealing with that. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, this PFAS issue that we've been dealing with is, I mean, again, it's a classic issue from back in the 70s and 80s when we didn't realize the impact we were going to have on our environment in the future, and using materials that were loaded with PFAS that have made their way into groundwater, and especially in Wisconsin, in certain areas, there's definitely hot spots, but it's everywhere. One of the challenges we had last session is we granted $125 million towards the PFAS program. But faced a veto issue from the governor's office that held that money in check. So we had to really negotiate significantly this session to get those funds released to start mitigating some of the problems with PFAS. So the biggest problem I think we had was trying to make sure that homeowners or landowners that we call innocent landowners were protected, that manufacturing companies that don't use PFAS but bring PFAS water in inadvertently would not be dinged if that water came in through their system and went back out. A great example is ND Papers in Buren, who use 100% recycled material for their pulp. And when you use recycled materials, it could be from anywhere in the world, and you don't know exactly what PFAS might be in existence in a recycled piece of cardboard that was originally made in China. So we're also trying to make sure, and we did a really good job negotiating the innocent landowner and innocent manufacturer provisions to say, hey, if you're bringing in water that's at a certain level and discharging it at the same level, we're not going to hold you as responsible as somebody who's using the actual PFAS generating materials. Back in the day, there used to be a lot of land spreading of sludge from different manufacturing processes. So landowners who had a previous and unbeknownst to them, bought a property that had some land spreading done at some point, or also had to be held held harmless for a period of time. So we negotiated that with the governor's office and the DNR to put provisions in, saying we're grandfathering you for this amount of time, but moving into the future, everybody's going to have to be responsible for solving the PFAS problem across the board. So there's some grandfathering provisions for all sides, but more importantly, the $125 million going out to our communities to upgrade water filtration systems, public service programs, you name it, anything that we can do to mitigate PFAS contamination is finally getting money out the door because we were able to sit down like adults and actually have a conversation on what both sides wanted and got the bill through the assembly, and hopefully now the Senate in the next couple of weeks, and the governor's indicated he would sign it if it stays the way it is.
Well, and then while we can say that we didn't know, the 3M, there's
Go
talk
ahead.
about whether or not they knew that the
Right.
PFAS was a damaging thing.
Yeah, and that's why when we, deal with the innocent manufacturing, innocent landowner provisions, that we also updated the spills law too to make sure the companies that we know are known users and known dischargers are held responsible. So it's a lot easier for us to clear up those misconceptions and say, okay, you really didn't know what you were doing, as opposed to, yeah, you probably knew what you were doing. The big examples are like the firefighting foams and Tyco's and Marinette and some of these other users that were very well aware of the old Wausau papers building, and just some that we already had a very good indication that we're using these materials and knowingly spread them or discharge them inappropriately.
Well, we've run out of time again, Scott Krug. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. It's always very educational, and I appreciate you updating our listeners. I'm Melissa Kay speaking with Representative Scott Krug of the 72nd Assembly District. Thank you again, Scott.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon.
All right, and thank you to listeners joining us for news in our community on Perspective 1320 AM, 97.5 FM, WFHR.